Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we're back for part two of our discussion of the offense versus the Bills. A frustrating loss. We got a lot of that out, I think, in part one. Jonas Schaefer is here to discuss the game. Jonas, thanks for joining me again.
Thank you, Ken.
I really appreciate the discussion for the first part, but Jonas has a great article coming out that I think will probably scratch the intellectual curiosity that some of the fans of this show will have with regard to questions about Harbaugh and blown leads. You want to talk about that a little bit before we move on?
Sure. It's just kind of an unscientific ranking of the five root causes of the Ravens' big late game implosions, those being in order from least annoying to most annoying, I guess. Mm-hmm. Special teams execution, obviously, because they haven't really had a whole lot of opportunities for Justin Tucker to get kicks when they're not moving the ball. Obviously, there was the Tyler Loop missed extra point, but that was kind of before things. I guess that was really that was a potential inflection point when things started to go south on Sunday. Fourth down aggressiveness, offensive execution, defensive execution, and then just bad luck.
All right. I was thinking of another special teams case, might have been against the Colts, but it might have not been at a 90% point there. And that was when they had the fair catch.
Yeah, that was the game. Remember, that was the game where they never were really in control of that one for whatever reason against who was the quarterback? It was a backup, right? Was it Gardner?
Yeah, I think it was Gardner Minshew. Okay. Yeah, so it was awful.
My favorite Ravens curio is that Gardner Minshew has more wins against the Ravens than Joe Burrow.
That's a good one. All right. We're going to talk a little bit of offensive line here. So, Jonas has done some research on the offensive line. He certainly watched the All-22 and gotten an opportunity to do that. I finished the offensive line scoring today with Maureen. So we've got our measures of it. We got PFF if you want to look at that. There's some significant differences of opinion on this game, more than I would normally say exist. But how about we talk a little bit about Ronnie Stanley first, who had undeniably the best game of any offensive lineman.
Yeah, I think he is not going against a thoroughbred pass rusher, but Greg Rousseau just got a lot of money. So I think he would be a guy, I think we're pretty confident in Ronnie's ability to handle speed rushers, because even though you could argue that all of his injuries have sapped him of some degree of athleticism, and as long as just the slow march of getting older, it is the guys who can get into his chest and knock him back and threaten that ability to anchor that perhaps worry you the most. And I think Rousseau has earned a reputation as being more of a power rusher than a speed rusher. So I think the fact that he was as rock solid as he was as a left tackle against what looked like primarily Rousseau, just you got to be thrilled with his preparation and his perhaps ability and readiness for Myles Garrett in week two.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know how much I can map this to success against Myles Garrett, but it was a great start for the season for Ronnie Stanley from a number of angles. I'll go through it really quickly. 50 plays, I had a map for 42 blocks successfully made. He missed 8, did not have any negative events. And this isn't a game. Everybody else had negative events. So he didn't have any penetrations, no pressures, no quarterback hits, no sacks, and no penalties. So it's 42 points out of 50, 0.84 per play. He did have one rush, and it was the one that ended up being the 19-yard run for Lamar, where he effectively allowed a pressure but was run out of it by Lamar. So in that case, he gets a zero R instead of what would be a share of -2 on that play. Probably would have gotten a -1 because Rosengarten also was equally guilty, I think, on the play. But in those terms, he gets a zero R, which effectively hits him on his adjustment. But he still gets in and squeaks in at the bottom of an A- for this game. I thought it was a terrific game. A lot of good mobility from Stanley in this game. And you mentioned, you know, part of it is just being able to handle whatever Rousseau can show you. And he had Bosa on that side some in terms of speed, but also be able to get out of level two, where he made 7 blocks in level two. He had 2 pancakes. He had a really nice block on one of the touchdowns, and I'm trying to remember which, or maybe it was a play that got the ball down in close. He just clipped somebody on the very left edge of the play, barely, I think a defensive back, and that freed up, might have been Flowers for that walk-in touchdown from 20 or so yards.
I can't recall.
Okay. All right. Hopefully I'm not making this up in my mind, but I have kind of a visual recollection of this. 2 pancakes, 2 out of 2 on poles, 2 highlights. So a nice set. You get a wonderfully intelligent lineman with Ronnie Stanley there. And Ronnie particularly is always cognizant of trying to contribute on the backside of a run play. Something he's done well since his rookie year. He was when he really didn't have any mobility, it was a big takeaway from his game. It was a big reduction in the quality of his play, was how much he was not contributing. He gets downfield to make blocks. He does a good job of blocking multiple players on the backside of a run play when he knows the amount of effort necessary to keep them from being impactful in the play is relatively limited, and he can get 2 on one play. Love to see that happen, but great performance for Ronnie. Vintage Stanley.
And best of all, he did not make week 1 illegal formations.
There you go. Yeah, that was a tough one to watch last year. I'll move on to Voorhees. I'll give you my notes, and then I'll have you jump in on what you thought also. Not a good game for him. 50 plays, 38 blocks, 7 missed, 1 penetration allowed. Okay, now this gets complex. He allowed 2.25 pressures. And that breaks down as 1 full one, 2 halves, and 1 quarter. There was a 4-way pressure allowed where it effectively was a jailbreak that ended up being a pass defense at the line of scrimmage. So 4 players were actually combined to have a share of that one. But he was one of them. Didn't have any quarterback hit sacks or penalties, so at least that's good. But his points per play were at 0.63 with an adjustment. And he did good reasons to get an adjustment. I'll get to in a second. He got up to 0.68, which is the minimum level to have a D at guard. So I thought it was a very tough game from Voorhees. Both a pass and run blocking, I wouldn't compliment him on either, but he did a few good things. He had 6 level 2 blocks, 3 pancakes. He was 1 out of 3 on poles, which is disappointing, but had 3 highlight blocks, which were, I think, primarily combinations, but there might have been one other of a nice level 2 push on a player.
See, maybe I was just looking at the – maybe NFL Pro did not come through for me with how it was filtering stuff. I thought he was better in pass protection than he was as a run blocker. And obviously I defer to you and your rigorous study of all these, but I have him, like, there's a double team on a 2-yard run, I guess, by Derrick Henry, and he misses Terrell Bernard, who ends up getting the tackle. He can't get off a double team in the third quarter to get to Dorian Williams, who's coming from the backside on a 3-yard run. Stuff like that, where just, you know, you see some of the week 1 iffiness and just the lack of time on task that these guys will get and do a better job of the longer the season goes on. And then, you know, he obviously had that the incredible rep on the Derrick Henry 46-yard touchdown run, where he just helps pave that unbelievably large run window for him to bust through. And, you know, he did a great job, of course, of kind of getting his butt in gear on the Lamar scramble, which I don't think Lamar really needed, but it was still nice to see. As Jason Kelce said, like a bus going 50 miles per hour in a 25 mile per hour zone, which is a
yeah, but he was line. About 15 yards downfield, wasn't he, when he, and still trying to make a block. So that's something.
Exactly.
Yeah. I love to see the effort, whether or not it's good. We saw Falele do that a couple of times last year, and it doesn't really mean anything, but I will say the one thing I love when a lineman maintains his momentum well and doesn't necessarily make sacrifices, I like that. I like it for fullbacks too, where they won't try and make a U-turn block if they can maintain their momentum and possibly make a level two or three block that would help. That happens most often on a pull or on a fullback bursting through a hole ahead of a player who doesn't immediately have anyone to block the line of scrimmage, and how he has to conserve his momentum, whether he turns to make a block or whether he continues downfield. Vontae Leach, ultimate conserver of momentum in terms of, I want to keep going forward.
Yeah, and I guess if you can recall, Ken, because I'm looking at it right now, that, like, looking at that last play, literally the last play of the offense in that game, which is the third nine, Lamar goes to Benford, but he gets the big hit. He obviously leaves the blitzer. He only gets a hand on the blitzer, and that kind of throws him. That takes him away from, I believe, Ed Oliver, because he kind of abdicates his responsibility to Oliver. And I just wonder if, again, that is a thing where, you know, the rule in offensive line play for blitz pickup is the most dangerous man is the guy who's closest to the quarterback.
Yep.
And maybe Voorhees recognizes the slot blitz and Ronnie Stanley doesn't. And so Voorhees is doing his job by initially picking up at Oliver, but then he sees that Ronnie does not have the blitzer, who is coming on a more direct path than the actual edge rusher. So Voorhees is stuck blocking two men when he should have really only had one, and Ronnie should have taken the inside guy. I remember one time early in the beat, I tweeted out a clip like, I can't believe, you know, the Ravens allowed this sack to happen. You know, what is Ronnie Stanley doing? And Ronnie Stanley was searching his name on Twitter and saw it and quote tweeted me. Did not have a good time that afternoon. So that lesson has been seared into my brain about picking up the most dangerous man. And I just wonder, you know, for all the people who are roasting Voorhees, whether he actually did the right thing and ends up getting penalized for, at least in the public perception, because he was trying to put out two fires at once.
Yeah, and he was trying to put out two fires. And I'll tell you how I scored that play. Okay, so he got a minus one on the play instead of a minus two. And there would normally be two components, two shares of that pressure given, since one of those guys was going to be unblocked. But my problem with him was he didn't get either one of them. The first thing he did was hook, put his left arm to basically hook Teron Johnson on the play. So I have a 72 hooks, blitzing seven outside, fails to block 91 inside after. So he's expected to block one of the two and blocks neither. There was nothing he could do about number two. So somebody was going to get to Lamar Jackson. I don't even care which one he gets, but he does have to get one. I wanted to follow the rules. Ed Oliver was slow playing it, by the way. He was actually slower getting through that hole than Teron Johnson was, which is a little surprising. And I'm trying to remember if Ed Oliver is coming from the other side of the nose tackle on the play, whether he's looping to that side, but I can't remember right now. I don't have the visual memory.
He's lined up over Voorhees.
He's lined up over Voorhees. Then he's just slow played the rep in that case, because Teron Johnson hit the hole first and he picks up the fist of Voorhees.
You, like, I, again, I'm just trying to read body language, but you wonder, I don't know if the Bills ever drop their interior tackles like the Ravens do on those sim pressures and creepers and stuff, but I wonder if they do, if by how Oliver still played it, whether he thought that this might be one of those exotic pressures and I've got to handle this guy as opposed to that guy.
It could be. It could even be that Oliver had a coverage responsibility theoretically, but I would say, in a basically 100% of instances where you drop the DT or the nose tackle, it's a short zone where you're expecting to play. You're not expecting something complex. I got to pick with him. I got to stick with him on some sort of wheel route or something. You know, you're not seeing that. All right. So in total, Voorhees graded out as a D, and I think I explained already all that, so I think we don't need to go over that again. Ready to talk about Tyler Linderbaum?
Yeah, just kind of an unremarkable game from my vantage point. You know, obviously doing his usual job of trying to put out fires and be the most responsible man inside next to two guys who don't have a whole lot of experience, or if you ask Ravens fans, a whole lot of quality. So that there were some plays where I'm sure he would like back, but I think overall, like a solid afternoon, a solid night, just nothing to play to write home about.
Right. I guess I'd mirror that. That certainly shows up in the grade. He got a 50 plays, 40 blocks, 9 missed, 1/4 of a pressure. So he was involved in the four-man play on that. That was his only negative event. Works out to be 0.79 his score. With adjustment, he gets up to a C, and really in the middle of the C range at center. 5 level 2 blocks, 3 pancakes. The one disappointing thing, he went 0-for-3 on his pulls in this game. Didn't have anything. Even this one play, it's actually very remarkable. But he and Stanley both pulled to the right, and he actually misses a block and then U-turns to try and block the guy in the back, which it just was a bad choice because Stanley made a perfectly good block on him. So if Linderbaum had maintained his momentum on that play, he might have had another player he could have blocked. But that was unfortunate, kind of a look on that play. Had 2 highlights during the game. One of them was a pickup at the line of scrimmage, which was very nice. A good game for Linderbaum, but this is one of the things I now am concerned about with the Bills is they look a lot bigger and a lot more freaking effective on the inside of that defensive line at nose tackle. Deion Walker looks terrific. And, Daquan Jones looked good in this game, I thought. Deion Walker really moves around pretty well for a big guy. And he had a lot of, what we've seen from Travis Jones in him at times, being able to move people around. So it was a real challenge for Linderbaum in this game. And I think if the Ravens end up playing Buffalo again in the playoffs, I think that's an area where the Ravens will have to try and figure out
if the Ravens do face the Bills again, they'll get a even deeper Bills front because they were playing this game without Michael Hoyt, who's a kind of powerful edge rusher, as well as Larry Ogunjobi, who is no stranger to the Ravens.
Yeah, and that assumes, of course, their depth holds up until the next time they play, which is a big if it's 18 weeks.
But I think Buffalo fans, like the very rich and vibrant Bills Twitter, and I do mean that complimentary, not pejoratively, but like they were really high, I think, on Dwayne Carter, I believe, who was their second round pick, who was a defensive lineman who they think has some juice. So as disruptive as they were with all their picks and stunts inside, they could be even better by the end of the year, or they should be even better.
It is a place where they've certainly improved. So a C for Linderbaum. Let's move on and talk about Fa'alele, because I know everyone wants to hear about Daniel Fa'alele's game. For some reason, a magnet for attention on the Ravens line more than anything else. But he finished last year very strong on the last 309 snaps. I've written extensively about that, so I'm only going to mention it briefly here. 50 plays, 40 blocks, 6 missed. He had a half plus a quarter pressure for 0.75 total. He had 1 quarterback hit allowed. That was all his. And he had the sack he quote-unquote allowed himself. I gave him 2/3 of that. I thought 1/3 of it was actually on Rosengarten for getting the pocket phone booth on that play. So he deserved it. I could also buy it if someone thought it was 5-1, but I thought Rosengarten basically allowed a pressure on the play, and I think it secured the fact that Lamar was going to be taken down on the play. Whereas Fa'alele, not only did he allow the rusher directly, it was also the first pressure on the play, and he fully deserved the lion's share of that sack. So anyway, 31.5 points for Fa'alele, 0.63 in aggregate, just like Voorhees. 0.05 in adjustment. I'll tell you why in a minute. So he also gets to the bottom of the D range. 8 level 2 blocks for Daniel Fa'alele. If you want to pick out one thing that was a positive from this game, 8 level 2 blocks is something he's had a lot of trouble doing in the past. And he just looked pretty good using his length a little better, I thought, in level 2. I wouldn't say it's anything about his mobility that's dramatically different. And I wouldn't really, although you made a good point about the one scheme play, I wouldn't really say that was what is impacting his level 2 blocking. I think he's using his length better is what I'd say, extending his arms and trying to make contact.
He is one of the notes that I put down was that he is long enough and strong enough to send Matt Milano flying on Derrick Henry's 30-yard touchdown run. Like, he gets maybe a fingertip on him and it displaces Milano, who's obviously built up a nice head of steam, like 5 yards. And that kind of clears the alley for Derrick Henry, I think, to run through. So a guy that big, 4 sequels, mass times acceleration, and he's got a lot of this man.
All right. Well, let's see, what else I have? 2 pancakes in the game, 1 out of 1 on poles. So he certainly did a lot better than, say, Linderbaum on pulls in this game, or Voorhees. So if you're looking for your great interior pulling machine, there's Daniel Faalele, and obviously I'm joking. Three highlights, but I have to say that every time, because anything positive I say about Faalele, I'm the most, you know, obscene, you know, Faalele biased person there is. Anyway, three highlights in the game. I thought you can pick out some things that were good about this game. This is a major regression from where he finished the end of last year. There's just no two ways about it. It's the bottom of the D range where he'd be played basically on a B plus A minus level for the last five games of last year. He'd gone 309 snaps at the end of last year with a total of three pressure events, one full pressure and two half pressures. That isn't much. In this game, he had four different pressure events in 50 snaps. So that's a big step back, unfortunately, for Daniel. Even though I could pick out something about the level two blocks, that's nothing like as important as keeping that pressure total low. Good that he didn't get penalized again, but I have a hard time really picking out really positives from this game for him.
Yeah, I mean, the highs and the lows are so extreme. You know, like I mentioned, the Milano block, there's also on another Derrick Henry explosive, the 49-yard run in the second quarter. He is the last person out of his stance, but he still saw, which is a common problem for Big Dan, but he still somehow manages to pancake Greg Rousseau, who's lined up on the right side there. It looked like Rousseau might have gotten tripped up slightly by Roger as he, you know, got to the second level, but it just like, wow, Rousseau is this beast of a run defender, and there's Big Dan putting him on his back. And then you have the bad stuff, which is like, how are you going to let Matt Milano, of all people, you know, slip off you on that Lamar sack at the end of the first drive after you've already handled a stunt? And then, you know, on there's a 5-yard loss by Derrick Henry in the third quarter where he can't cut off the backside three tech who is at Oliver, and it kind of leaves Roger Rosengarten hanging out to dry. So you know, maybe he is a guy who, like Roger Rosengarten last year, will get better the more accustomed to the game speed he gets, but certainly just not the kind of night that he's going to be putting on his free agency highlight reel.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree. He is playing against one of the really good three techs in the league in Ed Oliver. And I have Oliver as being the guy who beat him for the 2/3 of a sack on the final play of that first drive. Bull then beaten inside by 91 is my note on the play. I have to go back and watch it. You think Milano was involved though?
I can check as you talk right now.
Okay, sure. And you know, Oliver certainly got the sack, so there's no doubt about that. But that's how I had it had it recorded. All right, so we've been through Faalele. So I'll go through Rosengarten while you're taking a look at that real quick. Rosengarten had a tough night. 50 plays, 37 blocks, 6 missed. I'll get into that in a little bit. The penetrations, he had two of them. One of them was on the Derrick Henry fumble. It was all his, as I scored it. It wasn't anybody else's. Yeah, that's correct. Okay, and then he had two pressures as well. Check this on my sheet here while I'm looking at it. I know we made that correction. The score is the same. That's good. Okay. And then he had two 1/3 shares of the sack. And the first one I already talked about, he allowed the pocket to be phone boothed on the sack by Oliver when he was bowled by 50 is Rousseau, right? I'm thinking 57 is Epinesa, 50 is Rousseau. Yep. To phone booth the pocket. And then the other one was basically the sack where Lamar took an S0 on the play. I thought Rosengarten actually, he did allow a pressure, it looked like, on the play basically, but Lamar was able to move forward into what basically, again, would have been a clean pocket, and he decided to take off on his own. If he'd gotten positive yards, it would have been no charge at all, but he ends up getting back to the line of scrimmage, only taken down for a sack in name. That's really no different from an incomplete pass. I didn't feel it was fair to give him a whole 6-point sack anyway. I thought it was really a pressure that he allowed. So I went with the standard -2 scoring on that play. So a third of a sack. I credit him, the rest of it to Lamar on that play. Did have a false start. You know, they're trying to get the offensive lineman to hold their water. That's not a good thing. It's not a huge thing to have a non-declinable foul. Nice that the Ravens didn't have any declinable fouls on offense that I can remember. They had two false starts. No, they did have one. They had an illegal motion on Zay Flowers that basically acted as a safety blanket on one of the plays that ended a drive. Might have been the last one to It's not the Hopkins one. Where was the? No, it's on the third to last drive. There was a 9-yard pass on third and 13, and it wasn't good enough for a first down. But there's a declinable foul on Flowers that would have been very frustrating to Ravens fans had it been accepted.
I think I thought more highly of Roger than I did Dan. Obviously, I know that the false start tax is baked into the score. On the first sack, I know you didn't really give him a huge ding, but to me that looked like it was it would have fit my definition of like a passing cone. Like I thought there was enough space for Lamar if he needed to pivot to the right side where he could have stepped into a throw. I thought Roger did a good job of straining and kind of holding up on that power rush. I know you only have him down for 4 level 2 blocks, but I thought for the most part, he did a good job of not only getting to the second level, but, you know, establishing leverage once he got there and creating nice enviable running paths. You know, he gave another pressure to Bosa later on the long scramble by Lamar. I think you probably charted him with a pressure, but to me, that's like, if you're going to give him a pressure on that, then you probably give one to Ronnie as well, because it looked like they were like those two edge rushers were almost equidistant in terms of where they were from Lamar.
You're 100% right. It's a zero R in both cases, so neither of them got a negative deduction, but they both got zeros for their blocks on the play, and they both got a small ding in terms of their adjustment. But it wasn't a bad ding for either player compared to what it would have been if they'd given up individually.
Right, and then I already mentioned the him losing to Derrick Henry on the fumble play as he's trying to scoop Ed Oliver, and I think Dana Farley is pulling, so he's relying on a Linderbaum for help inside, if that is indeed the play design. So I thought, you know, certainly at the biggest moments, Roger was kind of an easy guy to pin as the culprit. But for me, an F doesn't really vibe with what I saw in going through the 53 plays.
Okay, well, fair enough. I know that if you look at PFF, they'll have markdowns for him on plays. They don't have the run plays clearly marked down about how far they're deducting from him for
some
of those.
Did he do poorly on PFF?
Let me check.
Because I will say, as you're looking it up, it was surprising to me considering what I thought, you know, from looking live before I looked at the tape and everything, that he'd had a suboptimal day as a pass blocker. But then you look at the pass block win rates, and I believe he was one of the, I don't know, like 20 or so offensive tackles who was graded out as 100%, which was interesting to me.
Yeah, I'm not buying that. He got a 44 run blocking grade from PFF, which is quite bad, and I had him for 2 penetrations in the game, so that would pretty much explain that. Although the Ravens ran a lot in this game, that would pretty much explain that. And then from a pass blocking perspective, they have him at 64.5. I'm sorry, I'm looking at Voorhees. Rosengarten, they had his 57.8 as a run blocker. So they must have not dinged him by too much on the Henry fumble, maybe realizing how much of a reach it was on the block. But they also didn't have him for any pressure events, which is just that does not match with you know how I define the things. And part of it, when PFF and I have differences, almost always is definitional in nature.
Right.
That it has to do with, you know, how much I require the cone to be not impeded and how they define it differently. And I can understand that's the case. And there, you know, the good thing is, I mean, we almost always agree on the direction of a play. So they might have dinged him by a half point on some of these plays where they didn't give him a pressure. Saying, well, he's gotten backed up, but he didn't give up a pressure on the play. It's minus a half instead of eight. But otherwise, I don't see how you get down to 64, because if he didn't have any events as they called it. So you had to have some negative plays that they scored for it to get down to 64. And yet I'm not sure exactly how that would have gone. Anyway, an F was the grade for Rosengarten in this game. The good thing, you know, a good thing about him is they really didn't give him much help. They only had 9 right side eligible receiver blocks the whole game. They had 9 left and 3 middle, only 3 right. So it's not a game where they gave him a ton of help. So at least he can point to it in that and said, I was responsible for more than I was last year.
Right.
All right. Let's put the offensive line to bed here and talk about some other things, because I know we want to talk about some individual skill position players. You're the guest. Who would you like to talk about first?
I'll talk about Zay. Just a couple of notes of some things. it was funny to look at the all 22 of the 39-yard crosser in the third quarter, because that was another play where that was one of the plays with the cheetah cadence, and he's actually, for as open as he was, on the broadcast copy, he's actually like incredibly slow out of his break because he doesn't actually realize the ball snapped. So it's funny to see where he was at the start of snap and where he was by the time the ball actually arrived. On the 23-yard screen catch and run score, I'm sure that this is taught, but it was interesting to see just how committed he looked to threatening vertically before he actually comes back to the line of scrimmage to catch that pass from Lamar. You know, I guess it is just kind of whatever you can do to create as much space as possible to give Ronnie Stanley, you know, as helpful a vector to the defensive back as possible. So I think that was interesting to see him like actually fully commit to making this screen route look like a go route, which is what you're supposed to do on basically whatever route you're running. It was, he got ridiculously wide open on the 36 yarder. That was just free money on that mesh concept. It looked like Charlie Kohler got in the way of the cornerback who was responsible for him in man coverage. On the D-hop touchdown, it was interesting. They sent him in that cheat motion where, you know, what Tyreek Hill popularized last year with the Dolphins, or 2 years ago, whatever that was, but you're, you know, basically sent in motion at the line of scrimmage so you can get a nice running start. So he is, you know, up to maximum velocity at a very, very high level. And that is to Deron Johnson's disadvantage, because even though he didn't get the target, it was a very interesting route where he's moving from the top of the screen to the bottom of the screen. He's, you know, basically gets snapped when he's around the slot, and he's kind of arcing toward the middle of the field, like 15 yards downfield. And he has this very violent cut where he kind of, almost like he's tracing a semicircle, starts to run back to the left side of the sideline, starts to run back to the sideline where he came from. And Deron Johnson is just in a blender and completely clueless about where he is or how to catch up with him. And at that point, Zay, you know, sees that the ball has been thrown. He kind of gives up on the route, but it was kind of spectacular to go back and watch, because I totally missed that in the live viewing. And then the one kind of funny thing, he was obviously called for a legal motion for starting up field, but that looks like a play that you see 15 times a game across the NFL where there are those slight starts upfield that just are never called. So it didn't even strike me as like egregiously apparent that he was starting up field before the ball had crossed before the ball was snapped. So that was a little bit weird to me, just to see the you know, a flag actually thrown on a play like that.
Okay, I hear you, but I'm saying I saw the Ravens do that, and particularly Flowers do it multiple times during the game. And so it's something where what I guess happened is they were probably warned that, right, I'm going to call it next time. And then he did it again. And I would say the one that happened, I would have been upset by Buffalo if it hadn't been called. I mean, it was definitely a move towards the line of scrimmage without question. It might have even been, and it would have been, I guess, a case where the Ravens had the wrong number of men on the line of scrimmage at the snap. That he was not only headed upfield, but you know, he was at the line of scrimmage as the ball was snapped pretty much. And you take another look at the play. I don't want to talk out of my rear end if you know, going from my visual memory basically. The other thing, and you mentioned this a couple times, but I picked out one thing you said that I really want to go back and watch, and that is he really selling a go route as opposed to a comeback? And Zay Flowers is a player that I think we can agree, his strength is not necessarily directly as a route runner, but in his suddenness and his lack of need to sink his hips that allows him to basically stick his foot in the ground and turn like a Ferrari at a right angle. And that's just undefensible. And he's never really had to learn to be a great route runner like Bateman had.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply, in-app only.
Where he's actually trying to read the leverage of the opponent and throw a little wiggle at him at the top of the stem so that he takes a wrong step and then he can break against it. Flowers doesn't have to do that because he could beat you by 5 or 6 yards by just having you be frightened of running at him and him take one hard step with his right foot and cut left if he wants to do that. He has an amazing ability. But I want to go back and look at that play that you're talking about where you say he really sold the go route. Can you give me a time reference on that or when it was? It was on the touchdown.
Yeah, it was the touchdown.
Okay, I'll look at that. And that's the play. You can take a look at that. That's the first drive of the third quarter, I think. It has a PL-23. I think that's the really good Ronnie Stanley block.
Yeah, with Linderbaum also out. By the way, the penalty that I just mentioned, it was called on Zay for a legal motion, so I assume that he was indeed the one responsible. But it was interesting to me that I think that the play that I believe was run in the preseason that I really liked because of how effective it was and how simple it was basically like having a very elusive guy basically run the old ankle route, Texas route, you know, out of the backfield and have a Tyler Linderbaum or a athletic lineman out in space as the one-man convoy. And they tried to do that, it looks like twice on Sunday. One time was the incompletion to Justice Hill on the underthrow by Lamar. And this one, based on how the play unfolded, even though it didn't unfold for very long, was similar where it is Zay in the running back position where they have, let me see if it is Linderbaum. It is Linderbaum also becoming the one man escort for Zay on the kind of angle route coming back over the middle. So if you want to impress your friends, like tell them to be on the lookout for that. Cause I think that will be a staple of the Ravens passing offense this season.
All right. Great stuff. Let's move on. I'll pick the next player. I think we really want to talk about, we'll talk about Derrick Henry, kind of some low hanging fruit here in terms of what's going on. Big game, breakaway runs, go in either direction. I thought the plays were very well blocked up. They took advantage of some of the wide receiver value the Ravens had. On one of the plays that was up the middle, you had a great play by Tyler Linderbaum that really deserves individual mention where he basically opened up both sides of the hole. You love to see this, you know, kind of a pin and turn move where he sealed off the left side first, and then he went to the right and got a I guess you would call it a kick out. And I don't remember if it was actually to the shorter side of the field, but it was effectively he was opening both sides of the hole with his two blocks on that play. And that was one of his highlights for the day. But Henry did a wonderful job of following blocks. It was a lot of yards before contact. It was a ton of yards after contact. Any way you break down his night, it was fantastic, except for the variance in success rate, which is the one thing that kind of bothers me about the Bills, that they weren't able to get him going effectively when they were in that fourth quarter and needed to sustain some drives.
Yeah, nothing I can add that's not exemplified by the highlights or the statistics or just what you saw. A little context from Next Gen Stats. He was obviously the number one running back in the NFL last year in rushing yards over expected per attempt, I think around like 1.9 or thereabouts, ahead of even Saquon Barkley. And on Sunday night, he came at a healthy 3 yards over expected per attempt. So the expected rushing total would have been about 115, and ended up with 169. It was also interesting that Next Gen Stats had him running into a heavy box, which they define as 8 defenders or more on only 16.67% of the time.
Okay, so only 3 of his 18 carries, then that would work out to be. Okay, now that's interesting. It felt like a lot more than that. It certainly felt like a lot more than that in the fourth quarter. He only forced 3 missed tackles forced 3 missed tackles in the game. Yeah. But 3.4 yards before contact, 6.0 yards after contact. I think he's got to be very happy playing at Baltimore is all I can say. This is a perfect environment for an older running back to basically move to Florida and have an outstanding opportunity to play with Lamar.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously he was in a bit of a dour mood after the game because of the fumble, which he took responsibility for. And I think as a media member, I would appreciate more responsibility for when things go wrong from the highly paid members of this Ravens team. But yeah, I'm grateful to have Derek be as forthright as he was.
I mean, you know, it's not an obvious situation where he has to go to the podium. I mean, that's not what Mark Andrews didn't go to the podium after.
I mean, this was in the locker room. I'm talking about just guys making themselves available in the locker room, which not everyone did on Sunday night.
Okay. And he was at the post-game podium, and he basically said those things as well. And that's, you know, you have a player who has a terrible game, makes a, you know, game costing. They don't often go to the podium. I mean, I remember Justin Tucker doing it after missing the extra point against the Saints in 2018 that cost him a game. And he said,
to be clear though, he wasn't at the podium. This was just in the locker room. The only two guys who went up at the podium, as far as I could tell, were Lamar and Kyle Hamilton.
But then how did they get the transcripts on for the website for that? Where did they get that from? Do you know?
The Ravens just have this, you know, very, very intense PR staff who basically get quotes from the guys. They send them to their army of transcribers, and boom, it's put up on the website.
Okay, so if you have a general floating ability to go around the locker room, talk to you want to, you go over to talk to Derrick Henry, there might be a PR guy right next to you also with a microphone in his face.
Yeah, or there might are, or in some cases, like because of how these things flow, we will talk to John Harbaugh, then Lamar Jackson, then Kyle Hamilton at the podium. And by the time that we enter there, Derrick Henry will have already left. But a PR staffer, this is more the case, this is almost exclusively the case for home games. A PR staffer who is assigned to the locker room will have already been on hand for the interviews with a Derrick Henry or Zay Flowers or Rashad Bateman, and will have already transcribed those and put them up on their NFL's, you know, / PR website.
Okay, who comes up with the questions for that? Then it's not a media member coming up with the questions for Derrick Henry if it's done in the locker room like that?
I don't know if there are any cases where a Ravens PR staffer will take the initiative themselves to ask a big player questions if like a TV reporter or whoever is not in there asking them themselves. Mm-hmm. So I can't say. I think usually like in preseason games, which are obviously far less important, you know, they used to talk to guys. Well, this is back in the days when the Ravens played starters. They would, you know, have a PR staffer go down to the locker room at halftime and talk to the guys who did play and get a couple stats for us that we could use in the game story. Because obviously by the time that we would get to the locker room, they would have already cleared out and, you know, gotten their car and driven home.
Okay. So it could be Ryan Mink or Cliff Brown or somebody like that.
No, they don't handle that. It would have been any of their, you know, lower on the totem pole, PR
people,
PR, you know, gotcha. Seasonal interns perhaps.
Okay. Yeah. Enough said. It gets great insight. I appreciate that, Jonas. Who else would you like to talk about?
I guess we already kind of maybe just like I could kind of sandwich Bateman and Andrews together because that's kind of the same theme. Bateman like opened on the first drive for a 12-yard comebacker, but Lamar goes to Derrick Henry on the check down instead. He was open. I think he had a really nice route on a vertical route that led to the 20-yard Zay crosser in the first or second quarter. But, you know, Lamar was never going to throw that because that route was kind of capped by the deep safety. But again, just adding credibility to the idea that Bateman can be a vertical threat that makes things mm-hmm. easier for his teammates. I think low-key, maybe my favorite Bateman highlight from Sunday was he, you know, I assume this is part of the X's and O's, but on the 49 yard run by Derrick Henry, he is not blocking the cornerback opposite him. He is approaching the safety, who in this case is Cole mm-hmm. Bishop, and just delivers one heck of a block that I don't think Bishop saw and definitely didn't appreciate because he just basically took him completely out of the play. So great job for Bateman as a slighter guy to show that he has some pop in the run game. And then I thought, you know, obviously it was interesting to see that on that long miss on 3rd and 10 in the third quarter where, you know, Ravens fans got understandably pretty pissed about the fact that there was no defensive holding or DPI penalty flag mm-hmm. thrown. Although I guess you could argue that, like, was that ball really catchable? But it looked like Zay was also held through the route stem on the other side of the field. Mm-hmm. And it looked like he was unhappy with that. So maybe a little bit of double jeopardy for the Bills that they got out of.
Yeah. I did not know about the Zay play on the other side of the field. I'm going to have to look at that now and see how egregious that was. I thought there was probably a little bit of turn of the shoulder, turn of the body of Bateman on the play that probably could have been called. wasn't. He's looking for the flag. You never know. You can't go by that because, you know, they ask for it a lot, certainly. All right. We have a question here I'd like to toss out there. It relates to Keaton Mitchell. It's from Jake Vogel, who's a regular listener and oftentimes on the show. He says, it's tough to criticize the running game much for this game. Do either of you believe Keaton Mitchell deserves an opportunity to get on the field for some real snaps? How much validity is there to Harbaugh's comments on Mitchell? We did cover that a little bit in the first show in terms of how you can use Mitchell. And we're representing two, not poles, but more like one, you know, explaining at least what Harbaugh's reasoning is. Do you want to take a crack at that, you know, in terms of having another?
Yeah. I mean, I think I either thought about tweeting or did tweet like at some point after that first preseason game, like everyone who's in the stadium and is watching Keaton Mitchell is going to take a late round flyer on Keaton in fantasy football in their fantasy football draft, just because of how explosive he looked. So if you are of the mind that special teams don't really matter, then I would understand that you would be very, very pissed about Keaton Mitchell not getting the first crack at snaps before Rasheen Ali. But if you think that special teams depth is important and you believe that, you know, John Harbaugh is not lying when he says that Keaton Mitchell is not good enough in the other phases of the game, and you think that the Ravens special teams, as I did, were just generally not that impressive, other than a couple of nice performances from guys like Tyler Loop, and, you know, obviously Jordan Stout deserved better with that that incredible punt inside the five, then you could see why they wouldn't want Keaton Mitchell out there, because they already have a very short, slight guy on kickoff returns, and Keon Martin, it looks like he was kind of a liability on one of those long runs, which is, all you know, kind of worrisome to see. So I think at some point Keaton Mitchell is probably going to have to force his way onto the field as like a guy who you can write in ink is going to be, you know, in every week presence. But until then, until he has like that classic Keaton Mitchell 2023 game, I don't know. Ken, I mean, like, are we going to be talking about him being on that game day activation roster bubble every week?
Yeah. Okay. So I think I appreciate that, because I think you're representing what Harbaugh is trying to say about the thing. And I think I don't think John Harbaugh is lying. I think he may be misvaluing what's going on when he says that the, you know, everybody knows where the ball is going if Keaton Mitchell's on the field. First of all, if that's true, you got them. You got them by the nuts, if that's true in terms of what's going on. But I'll look at it as this. Ali played one snap of offense. He played 21 snaps of special teams, which was among the leaders, which means he's probably playing three units, but not four. Okay. And I don't know which unit he wouldn't be playing, but if I had to guess, the unit he wasn't playing was punt.
I can look it up. I can look it up for you.
So you got it on PFF. So it'd be the punt unit, not the he'd be playing on the punt return unit, maybe as a jammer, but maybe not on the punt unit, because there's limited places that he can play, because he can't be a gunner at his size. He there's a lot of things he can't do, but it'd be on that unit that I bet he was not playing.
He got three snaps on punt return, three snaps on punt coverage, seven snaps on kick return, and eight snaps on kick coverage.
Okay. Very good. Very good. Okay. So 21 in total. So I look at those 22 snaps you got out of Ali, and Ali was on for one of the pony snaps, which had been perfect for Mitchell. It was a 5-yard run for Ali. I can't say it would have been better, but he represents a much more credible threat, I think, than Ali does in terms of the defense actually being concerned about him getting the football. If you have Mitchell in the game, he's not going to get just one snap of offense. He's going to get several snaps of offense. I don't know whether he's going to get four, or I don't know whether he's going to get nine, but he's going to get some credible number of snaps, and he's going to play a little bit of special teams and be your best kick returner. They sacrificed having basically a swap out of Mitchell for Ali on the kickoff return. I've got to admit, is a fairly marginal gain, but I think that the value on the but I think it is a gain, and I think the value on offense, the gains from that are probably more significant. And if I'm looking at this, at the 21 snaps that Ali played on special teams, boy, I have a hard time really putting a value on that. I mean, first of all, a bunch of them, you know, when the ball came up short on the kickoff, doesn't matter if you have Ali on the field or not, obviously, for a play like that. The ball goes in the end zone. It doesn't matter whether you have Ali on the field or not for that one. The punt that gets covered by Simpson, I don't know if he's on the field or not for that play, but it obviously didn't matter if you have Ali on the field. So there's actually – it gets to be not as likely that any individual player is really going to impact that special teams. I know that'll be something I'll get crucified by probably for people who are real special teams gurus, but I think you're kind of letting the cart drag the horse if you want to degrade your offense for a really marginal gain on special teams that you could get from having Ali over Mitchell. And obviously,
And you could do all kinds of sliding doors hypotheticals where, you know, if you wanted to make the case, as I think I probably did, that Jalen Armour Davis deserved a spot on this roster more than Rasheen Ali. Mm-hmm. And if you trust Jalen Armour Davis, like I would have based on how exceptionally well he played in the preseason, then maybe you don't need Jair Alexander for as many snaps or as crucial snaps as he got on Sunday. And maybe Jalen Armour Davis is able to make one or two of those plays in the fourth quarter that keeps the Bills from that comeback. But obviously this is all just kind of blue sky and stuff. And it's
right.
Don't want to waste any more breath than that. We have to.
At least I kind of understand the move away from Jalen Armour Davis, because I think it's a multi-year, but attempt to get a multi-year gain as opposed to a single year gain. So I kind of understand it. They didn't project him for a lot of snaps this year. I kind of would have projected him for more snaps, I think, given the fact that the third and fourth guys for the Ravens have very questionable durability.
Yep.
Not to mention, I wouldn't ascribe Marlon Humphrey as the most durable cornerback in the league.
And Nate Wiggins is still looks like a twig out there, even with those extra 10 pounds of muscle.
Yeah, there you go. So all very good points. I think we talked about a little bit about DeAndre Hopkins. Let's assume that the Ravens have to be without Isaiah Likely for another week here, because I think it's probably more likely than not that they'll have to play without him against the Browns. Maybe you have some insight into that. That's different. Is he on? He's on the practice field again.
Yeah, he was. He was doing some like agility ladder stuff on Friday. Mm-hmm. Nothing too explosive. I don't think he was running more than like 60%. Of his max speed, no real violent cuts. It looks like he put on his Instagram, I think on Monday, I believe, him doing some more lateral mobility. So again, that kind of maps with the timeline of him being probably at least a week away from playing, which is fine. You know, like I don't think they'll need him against the Browns, as evidenced by the fact they are 10.5 point favorites, I believe, over Cleveland as we speak right now. But it certainly would help to have him.
That's down. They were 12 and a half last I checked on Odds Checker. That's not good. All right. So anyway, that's a, you know, what, maybe it's good news, I guess. You'll know better tomorrow, because Wednesday is the first day of practice and you'll see more of where he is. Likely is a player who I don't believe plays special teams anymore, right? Or did he play some last year?
I don't think so.
Okay, so it's he and Hill is protected. Hill moved into the protected class of starter, except for kickoff returns. And Likely, by the way, that's another place where you want an extra special teams player. I've got no problem putting Justice Hill out there at risk for a few more special teams plays to get Keaton Mitchell into the backfield. And that's another very legitimate, you know, case to be made there. And I don't think it would be, first of all, Hill's going to be way above where Ali is as a special teams player, because he's been a pretty good gunner during his career. Anyway,
right.
Enough said. Jonas, always a pleasure talking football with you. Tell folks.
Before we go, I got two things to bring up with you. I know obviously you did the bulk of your published work so far was on the offensive line, but did you have a general takeaway from watching Mark Andrews?
You know, other than he was not targeted, no. I thought it was very interesting that he and Flowers ended up on the same spot in the field, so there may have been an option route involved on that play. But the fact that Flowers came back and picked off the ball, I'm not sure it was intended for him. Do I think he looks slow? I don't have enough basis for that. But maybe from looking at more extensively at the All-22 for the receivers in particular, you might have picked up on some of that.
Yeah, I mean, not a whole lot of those vintage Mark Andrews, like Y cross plays where you can really see that separation. I thought obviously he was a good run blocker in space in that first half. But your point about him ending up in the same airspace as Zay was interesting, because I think it happened more than once. On the there was a third and seven play, I forget if the Ravens got it. I think they did, where he kind of sort of ends up running into the same space as D-Hop. Again, because of how new D-Hop is to this offense, maybe you're more inclined to blame him than Mark, but obviously Mark has long enjoyed latitude about in terms of where he goes, especially for his zone in this offense. So that was interesting to see. There was also on the play that led to the fumble and the big loss by Justice Hill. Mm-hmm. It looks like he has, you know, the crack block responsibility on Joey Bosa late in that first half. It seemed like one of those plays where it's almost like doomed from the start based on how wide his alignment is from the line. So like once Bosa realizes that this ball is going out wide and triggers, it looks very, very difficult for anyone, but especially Mark, who is not does not have the blocking power of Charlie Kohler or Pat Ricard to handle it. But if you are pointing a finger at someone on that play, it probably is Mark, but maybe you should also point a finger at Monken just for not giving him the flexibility to kind of reduce his split and giving him an easier look at that. So that was interesting to see as well. And then of course, I mean, probably the most consequential play is like on that final play of the game.
Zay Flowers.
On the final play of the game where Lamar goes to Hopkins, short of the sticks, it's a zone blitz. And Mark starts, you know, as kind of the detached tight end, and he veers out to the sideline on like a diagonal route. And it was interesting that based on the all 22, where you're looking from behind the offensive line, like Lamar is peeking at Teron Johnson, who's coming from that same side. So I don't know why when Mark starts to uncover and gets quite open as he's running this route to a vacated zone, Lamar doesn't stay that way. Maybe he thought that the cornerback who was kind of backpedaling to the sticks would have been able to break on that and tackle him short of it. But I think if he'd held on to that a little bit longer and trusted the protection would have held up based on how far Mark ended up from the nearest coverage guy, that would have been like a walk-in first down. And, I don't know if that is telling of where Mark is in the passing progression or in the offensive hierarchy, but it definitely was something.
Okay, you open up two things. I want to pop back at you, and I think you have one more point to make too. The first is that it is more common to have two players in the same area, not only when there's an option route, but also when that's the play design, which a lot of the plays have rub or pick concepts where you're actually running people to the same spot. So when the ball's out quickly on some plays, it's more likely that you might have two players in the same position. The ball doesn't usually go there, because by its nature, that's not usually an area where the quarterback sees a lot of value in the throw, but it does happen on play. So it's not something to get too worried about. The play I was talking about, and I interrupted you with before hearing out your sentence, and I apologize mm-hmm. for that, was the jet toss to Flowers. And it was a run and not a pass, which went right for nothing. And he basically slid down to, I liked it that he slid down to keep the clock moving. But Mark Andrews did nothing on that play in terms of a block. Looked really bad. Now,
he blocked his guy, but he didn't block the guy who he should have seen also coming.
Yeah. And you say he blocked his guy. I think he got released very quickly, is my recollection. There were snipers all around there ready to take Flowers down on the play. So it wasn't like he was going for a first down after that, right. But it was an unfortunate circumstance. I didn't think it looked very good for Andrews on the play. You had one more point you wanted to hit up with.
What was it? I think the one demerit that I think I would hold against Lamar, and again, this is just like absolutely pitch perfect, like Monday morning quarterbacking from a guy who's never had to run a read option in his life. But I did take some issue with like the actual reads themselves. And this is like, again, very, very minute stuff. Let me see if I can find my notes here. There's a handoff to Derrick Henry on the first drive with an arc block by Andrews that I think Lamar should have kept. There was another one late in the first half that leads to a 5-yard run by Henry, but I feel like it could have been more if he keeps it himself. There's another on the final, and then there's another on the final offensive play I guess this would have been the second to last offensive play.
The Flowers jet sweep. Right. Yep.
I think my note was talking about the final offensive play of the first drive, or of a, I think it's the final offensive play of the first drive, because it was Lamar has the keeper, and he like kind of goes nowhere against Bosa, who has him in space, and the Ravens like settle for that big long field goal. I forget exactly when the first half it happened, but there was another keeper where he keeps it, but it looked like Hill had advantage to the play side. And then obviously on that second to last play on the wide receiver option pass where Zay is screaming across the formation, that was also a situation to me where it looked like there was more of a numerical advantage inside, especially with what looked like Voorhees kind of pulling from the left guard spot to the right and potentially being a guy who could make the Ravens' life easier. So I don't know. Like, obviously it's an incredibly
picky.
Fast. You have to be very, very, it happens in a snap. And, you know, if you don't feel good about the mesh point, then obviously you're going to keep it rather than risking it. But I just always am going to trust Lamar's ability to accelerate and to get outside the edge, especially against a guy like Bosa, who looked as slow footed as he did at times, rather than just like giving it. I mean, there were just, you know, on some of those plays that I mentioned, the Ravens had an obvious numbers advantage, like 3-3. And if Lamar takes it and is able to beat that guy to the corner, I think like the play that we saw in that first half, where it's like an easy 13-yard run, he could have had at least a couple of those, based on my completely inexpert opinion of what he should have done, you know, right, 48 hours after the fact.
Well, that's a, yeah, it's two plays you would take it from Lamar. It's somewhat picky, but you know, every read option is its own decision that deserves some inspection in space. And you know, on its own merit. And if you want to get intentional about your practice, you look at those, and I'm sure the Ravens will, and try and help Lamar make better decisions. Although you're really teaching somebody who has Muhammad Ali's instincts with regard to opponent leverage to dodge punches better. That's effectively what you're doing. I don't think there's anybody in the world who could have taught Muhammad Ali to dodge punches better. Right. I just don't think there's anybody who could have taught him something. You know, no. You're not thinking at the 4-millisecond level, you know, kind of.
Because I don't want to end this with me kind of sort of slamming Lamar, I will say that maybe the one of the low key most impressive things, and again, I don't know if this was already in the script for the play, but on the Derrick Henry 30-yard touchdown run, mm-hmm. If you remember, they line up in shotgun, they motion over to I formation. It's a big change in what it looks before the snap, and then right before the toss, he widens Zay Flowers' split. Was it widens Zay Flowers' split to basically take the cornerback out of the run fit, which mm-hmm. ends up being very important, because I think that's a toss to Derek, and he's able to have more space than he otherwise would have, and you know, run by the safety, who was just completely clueless about that stopping him. So if that was something that Lamar decided was useful as a tag to the play, that he motion Zay Flowers over like 4 or 5 yards to help out Derrick Henry because he realized that this play could really hit, then all the credit in the world to Lamar, because I think that's something that probably the certainly the Ravens would never tell you like after the game, you know, was part of the plan, because they are very, very tight-lipped about what right. is and isn't in the playbook. But if it was indeed something that he kind of dreamed up on the fly, then big ups to him.
Yeah, well, I wonder if Lamar would ever talk about that if questioned at the podium after. So maybe not. I had two very minor complaints. And again, 144.4 passer rating kind of speaks for itself. He had a near perfect day. If he had hit on these two passes, I wonder if he would have actually had a perfect day, because it would have been very close. But the two passes that he missed on were two plays where he basically did something we've seen from him in the past, and that is he tried to hand the football to the receiver. And what I mean by that, he really short-armed a ball where the receiver had plenty of space around him. And the first one was two in a row. The second one was the Hill play, which was right at his feet and was thrown low. And it was the play before that, which I don't have a better description of it. But it's the first play of the fourth quarter.
He missed Zay on the crosser, and Bateman was wide open on that play, too.
Yeah. All right. So anyway, two different throws. If he gets that, I guess he's 16 for 19 as a passer. That's sufficient to make the minimum percentage for the I think that would have given him a perfect passer rating. It's a shame, but incredible day for Lamar. And obviously he's off to a fantastic start, and we don't do anything but love him here. And I don't think there's, you know, I don't really think there's any legitimate criticism of Lamar in terms of he cost the Ravens the game here. You know, he made it possible. So,
and that's why this is every implosion is its own fresh nightmare, because no two implosions are the same under John Harbaugh. That there's always a new culprit. It's just it's a constantly moving target.
Yeah. All right. Do you feel like we have a desire to, maybe too much of a desire to find blame in someone?
Are you talking like in the general political climate or what?
No. I really was talking about as sports fans, maybe more generally. In this case, obviously, it is a common thread that Lamar and Harbaugh have been here for the period at which people want to seem to measure, whether you're talking about one score being a losing one score games or losing games in comeback fashion. You've got some common threads, and there's a desire to find one person. I think your article, as I pick up on it, is going to do a really good job of kind of looking at these individually and see what went wrong.
Yeah. I mean, there's more information available than ever before and in richer detail than ever before. So if you want to make Daniel Filele your whipping boy for the week, then all you have to do is go onto x.com and search 77 or Filele. And there he is going to be, you know, looking like a turnstile on one or two plays. And to some people, that's enough to hang a guy in effigy.
All right. Well, Jonas, great talking football with you again. Tell folks where they can find your work online and read your banner article about the more recent troubles giving up leads.
Yeah, just thebanner.com. You can also go to thebaltimorebanner.com. If you still have that bookmarked, it will redirect you either way. And yeah, we've got plenty of great stuff. Obviously, with the Orioles wrapping up, we've had a great year of coverage from our guys, Andy Koska and Danielle Allentuck and John Mioli. And, you know, obviously Ravens coverage picking up now with me and Gianna Hahn. Our columnist Kyle Goon, Childs Walker is now running for us. I know you've had him on, Ken, obviously a long time Baltimore Sun veteran who, took a buyout there or left. I forget exactly what the details were, but we're glad to have him contributing and doing his usual five things we learned.
Great writer, very versatile too in terms of what he can write. He's writing about political stuff and all kinds of local news that's been very effective. We really enjoy having Childs on the show when he's on. Thanks so much for joining us, Jonas, anyway. Other folks out there, thanks for your support of the show. As always, tell one new person about it if you can. Show an older person where they can listen directly on the website. That's always appreciated. Jonas, thanks again for coming on.
Thank you, Ken. Appreciate it.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.